Good morning and welcome. Welcome to Matt Nair on Air. So very happy to have you along with us. Jane Matt Nair, Greg Bach, Calvin Butenhoff coming to you live from our studio in downtown Waukesha. You can join the show, call or text at 855-75-CIVIC or leave a comment on the live stream if you're watching on Facebook, YouTube, and or Twitter. Very excited to have our next guest join us. It is the last week of Women's History Month, so we're getting around to this a little bit late. But we're going to be talking about famous medieval women, and our guest is a Marquette University Associate Professor of History. Professor Leslie Knox is here. Good morning, Leslie. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning. Every month is Women's History Month.
Absolutely. It certainly should be, right? So you have published three books about medieval women and work on gender in the Middle Ages with a specific focus on women in religious movements. And I wanted to start off by asking just how difficult is it to research medieval women, because they typically weren't the ones writing down history?
That's a really great question. I think a lot of people have that assumption. And we can certainly, you know, if we were to quantify all the sources, more would be written by men. But if you want to study medieval women, religion becomes a really awesome lens with which you can do that. We have women who are authors. We have women who will dictate to male scribes. And we also have tons of writings about them. But, you know, I think that is kind of a common perception. And I kind of want to turn it to the three of you and sort of say, well, what do you think you know about medieval women?
Nothing.
Because there is sort of that assumption.
Well, okay, here's my guess. So you were either a serf, which was not so great. If you were, you know, the companion of a serf or the wife of a serf, that wasn't such a good life. Then you were either married to a tradesman, right? Maybe someone who makes wheels, or I don't know, is a
barber.
A barber or a iron worker or whatever. And then there's the upper crust and the royalty, where the women learned how to loot. I don't know what they did with their time.
But that's exactly it. Is, you know, we get, you know, who's in the movies? So is it the princesses, a Disney princess, or even the Game of Thrones, a sort of elites? But then think of the best movie ever made about the Middle Ages, Monty Python and the Holy Grail. And so think about that scene, you know, the Marxist peasant scene, and where, you know, King Arthur comes up and says, you know, old man, I'm a woman. And sort of talking, you know, about those things. Every scene in that movie can be traced to a medieval document.
Look at the violence inherent in the system.
Hilarious.
Yes. No, I tell my students, if you want to study the Middle Ages, you can't do wrong by watching Monty Python.
My favorite line in that movie is, like, there goes a king. How do you know it's a king? He hasn't got poop all over him.
No, but that's exactly it. And that ties in with what, you know, Jane brought up. So if like 90-some% of our population are basically agricultural workers, you know, at least until we're getting to the 11, the 1200s, I mean, most people are involved in sort of subsistence level. But they're the ones who often get more left out, or history, you know, is written onto them.
Yep.
As opposed to really getting their voices. And that's kind of one thing that's so great about women and religion, women in the church, you know, that you do get more sources. I mean, I should say, you know, I told your producer, you know, I say movements, and that's partly to kind of broaden our categories. Because I'll also say to students, you know, the Christian Middle Ages, that's one of our like lenses through which we look at that. But then there's the church as an institution, there's theology, there's the doctrines. And then there's what people actually did, you know, and that's the most important and the most interesting way that I really think you can study women and gender and all of those kind of topics.
Our guest, if you're just joining us, is Leslie Knox. She is an associate professor of history at Marquette University, and we're having her here to talk about Women's History Month, and we're talking specifically about women in the medieval ages, and you have written three books about that. You must speak you must speak numerous languages, Leslie, I assume.
You do. I mean, if you want to do medieval history, you know, one of the first things I'll say to students is like, great, how's your Latin?
Yay.
It's becoming much less of a thing that people do. But I also will always say to students, Latin is an awesome language to study compared to, say, like German. It only has six irregular verbs. Most people don't speak it today. So if, you know, if you're, it's about pronunciation and all of that, you know, that's going to be easier too. But a lot of the documents are written in Latin. That's certainly true, you know, into the 13th century. But I specialize sort of in the 13th through the 16th century. And so they're writing in the vernacular languages as well. My women write in Italian and Latin, often both at the same time. There'll be different dialects. Like the first time I encountered somebody writing from Sicily, it really took me a while to figure out what was going on in the text. So
I can't even imagine. I honestly can't. I give anyone who can speak multiple languages or read multiple languages, that's just a facility that I lack.
Well, and remember that we're working with handwritten documents. So you're not only learning medieval versions of the languages, but you're also learning how to read handwriting from the past.
Oh, man.
So it's called paleography. And so you learn a lot about how the manuscripts were made. And we think a lot about, well, okay, it's written down, but who's reading it? Maybe not even reading it. I mean, a text can be transmitted orally as well. So all of these different things. But yes, it sometimes spend a lot of time just trying to read the darn text.
Leslie, so I'm going to bring this question as quantifiably short as possible. So with all your history, with all of the things you've read and researched and put out there, what are a couple of misconceptions that we have through movies, through TV shows, through even like historical or religious documentation that we've been taught through the years, sure, that just different than like, you can just say like, no, that's not how women were. Stop watching these shows.
Yeah. That's such an awesome question. I think in some ways, so like, let's take the stereotype of a nun, especially drawn from sort of like Gothic fiction. And so women who are forced into these cloisters where they're expected to be silent and chaste. I mean, that's a literary trope that you'll certainly get in the Middle Ages itself. They love to have sort of raunchy stories about nuns and priests. I mean, the kind of things at a tavern, they're called fablio. So we can certainly find some of them. Did some women not have a vocation, wind up in a convent because their family was maybe making marital alliances for other daughters? Sure. But that could also be a way, not only for women who had a pious vocation, but could also really be a way to control your life. Medieval religious women in these communities, they could be convents, they could be looser associations. They had a lot of power and they often had a lot of respect. There's sort of a phrase that gets used in the 15th century about book-lined cells. So if you were a woman and you wanted to read and write, maybe you wanted to teach, a convent would be a great place for you to potentially be. Religious communities often owned a lot of property, and so you could be one of the most politically powerful figures there as well. So I think that's kind of one of the stereotypes. They also always will say to my students, you know, your mileage may vary. You know, you've met one, then somebody else might have sort of a different thing. What I like about some of the women I study is they do have control over their lives.
Well, and that's something I would never have considered, that you would join a convent in order to retain some sense of autonomy, essentially, right? It was about control and being able to control your own life as opposed to just being married off to someone for a political alliance.
Sure. So Clara of Assisi, for example, she's sometimes called, you know, the female founder of the Franciscan order. She is one of Francis of Assisi's first followers. If you were to read her saint's life, hagiography, this becomes a genre that in some ways we think like, well, this is kind of boring. These are pious models and they're all kind of sound alike. But if you read them, you kind of can read between the lines and you also get a lot of personal anecdotes. But if you read the life of St. Clare, at first blush, it seems kind of boring. So the male writer who's writing it, his name is Thomas of Celano, and he's kind of, oh, she was silent. She devoted herself to prayer. She's in the cloister. But what's really fun is we not only have this life, we have what's called the canonization process. This was basically a legal investigation into whether or not she was a saint. Clare is in really the first couple of decades when the Roman Church was kind of taking control of sanctity. It just wasn't that other people thought you were pious. They were promoting different cults. And they thought, okay, we really need a woman who can be a model for a nun. That's kind of our ideal. And that really kind of wasn't Clare. I mean, she was okay with her community, But there's one point, well, like her sister wants to join her. And her family's like, no, we're going to marry her off. Claire prays. And all of a sudden, she's as heavy as a boulder. They're physically unable to move her out of this. There's a point in the 1230s where they say, well, you know, we're not going to have these guys for your pastoral care. She stages a hunger strike. And then if you look at the canonization process, where these women who lived with her are saying, like, here's who the real woman was. Here's what made her a model. And you can see the sort of like clerical interlocutors. They're like, no, let's talk about this. And they're like, no, wasn't that way at all. Here's what Claire did. Here's where she pushed back at the Pope, at these cardinals. And it's just great. You can kind of put these sources in dialogue with each other.
That's gutsy. I mean, beyond belief today you can thumb your nose at the Pope on Twitter. But back in those days, if you got in the Pope's face, he might never see you again.
Yeah.
Especially if you're a woman.
She and a lot of these other women, I mean, they know how to work around these sort of social elites. I mean, that's who their background might be, as well as others. And in many cases, like if I think of the Beguines in the north, these were pious lay women who were really important for sort of charitable movements, who performed sort of hospice care, took care of the poor. I mean, they were incredibly well respected. So lots of different ways to kind of get into their experiences.
Leslie Knox is our guest for Women's History Month. She is an associate professor of history at Marquette University. We have Mark from Prairie du Sac, who's been very patient on the phone. We only have a couple minutes left. Mark, what did you want to say?
Yeah, I haven't read any Ms. Knox's books yet, but I have read Thomas Cahill's Changes of History. And one of the characters that jumped out to me in his one on the Mysteries of the Middle Ages was Ellen of Aquitaine, who... Sounds like, to my ears, a fairly modern woman. I mean, she believed in regular bathing. She made her pages wash their hands before they ate. She was mother to Richard the Lionhearted, and, you know, bad Prince John, and she was probably more capable than either one of them.
Mark, I'm sorry we got to cut you off because we're going to break. You can hang on if you like, and we will finish this on the other side. Do you have a time for a second segment, Dr. Knox? Or Professor?
I do.
Great. Leslie Knox will be here when we return. Stay close. You're listening to Matt Nair on Air. We're coming to you across the Civic Media Radio Network.
She takes a swing, man. She can't hurt. She don't mean no harm. She just don't know what else to do.
Good morning. Thank you so much for joining us. Welcome to Matt Nair on Air. Jane Matt Nair, Greg Bach, the Surgeon of Sound, Calvin on the board, coming to you from our studio in downtown Waukesha. You can always join the conversation. Call, text at 855-75-CIVIC or leave a comment on the live stream on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter. Our guest for Women's History Month, she's an associate professor of history at Marquette University, Leslie Knox is here. And right before the break, Leslie, Mark had brought up Eleanor of Aquitaine, who was a pretty phenomenal historical figure. It's The Lion in Winter, if you haven't seen that movie, it's absolutely stunning. How historically accurate that is or not is a question for you, I guess.
Is that the one with...
Katharine Hepburn.
Yep, I just watched that recently for the first time. Good. I'm like, these people are crazy.
There's never been a family in history who has needed therapy more.
Yes.
And so the dialogue, you know, and the way it's staged, I guess there's recently been a remake. Okay, maybe not so historically accurate, but this was a really tempestuous family. And, you know, for the caller, if he's interested in Eleanor, I would absolutely encourage him to read more. I was at a conference 2 weeks ago. I know there's a new book out from Chicago about her, but there's lots of really wonderful studies. So here's this woman. She's the most desirable heiress in Europe. She's the heiress of the County of Aquitaine, so incredibly rich. She's one of the first patrons of the troubadour. She loves romances, having fun. She marries this guy who is originally going to become a cleric. He's going to become the King of France, Louis VII. He's a little bit dour. It's not really a good match. It's been worked out, but this very powerful abbot, Suger. They go on crusade together, what will become the Second Crusade. It's a catastrophe. She will be placed under tent arrest or house arrest at one point. There are rumors going around she's having an affair with her uncle. This leads to a divorce. She'll eventually marry Henry II. That's where Richard the Lionhearted, John of England. But through all these things, I mean, she's wealthy. She's powerful. She is an excellent political administrator. When Richard the Lionheart goes on crusade, she's the regent. On his way home, he winds up kidnapped, held for ransom by an Austrian duke. And it's Eleanor who basically takes the entire income of England to pay for him. I mean, she'll live probably into her 80s.
Wow.
So she's really great. And I think things like The Lion in Winter or some of these novels, there's a children's novel by E.L. Konigsberg, who did The Mixed Up Files of Mrs. Baisley Frankweiler, which is probably the most familiar novel now. These are a great way to sort of launch our curiosity and say, okay, yeah, I want to go learn more about this Eleanor. What's accurate? What's not? Kelvin, you know, you mentioned The King about Henry V. Same thing. I mean, another really interesting figure, you know, so Shakespeare has the plays. There's been wonderful movies by Kenneth Branagh and others. And his sister, Philippa, Catherine, his wife, very much do, when the men are off at war, who's running the state? Who's running the estate? These are things that the women certainly are very well qualified to do.
That's so nice to hear. It just is that they weren't all, you know, weaving and there were other functions that they fulfilled. It just has been gone kind of unsung for a long time.
It also seems like the women, you know, I don't want to make a comparison to nowadays because everything is different because we're talking about more people of means and higher status and class. But was there, you know, for these individuals that you were just speaking of, was there an intimidation factor? Were men intimidated by them, or was it just understood these individuals run the show while the king or the husbands at war are away, and that was the normal cycle of life?
Sure. So I hate to bring up the F word, feudalism. Feudalism is, you know, like that. Do you think back to middle school, that pyramid, yeah, so like the king on top and those levels? Yeah, that's an invention of like 16th century French lawyers. Medieval society certainly had those sort of vertical relationships of power, but also these horizontal ones. And so where you're talking about, like, do people recognize their power? That was something that was always kind of being negotiated. And I think the modern comparison is really interesting because we think about like networks and we think about connections and we think about what's behind them. And so they're doing sort of similar things. So like with Eleanor, Eleanor was referred to in the documents as both a lord and a lady. And we'd say, well, wait a minute, that's kind of a gendered category. No, it was sort of a job title in some ways. You know, what was she expected to do?
Interesting.
I'm going to start calling you Lord Jane.
Lady Jane works too. Leslie Knox is with us. She's an associate professor of history at Marquette University. We're just about out of time, Leslie, but I did want to ask you, and I was thinking about this last night as I was trying to go to sleep, and I knew we were having you on. I went to Catholic grade school through eighth grade, but when I was really little, I remember we had a booklet on the saints and how all the saints died. And we all the kids had a competition.
Fun.
I know, but the kids had a competition. Like, what did your saint get crushed by, or how that, yeah, that was how you won? Is if it was the most, you know, she died being on a wheel on a rock, and it's like, well, then I won.
My saint was crucified upside down. Boom.
Well, so during grad school, we were like, well, what if we had like a medieval studies advertising agency? And so like the St. Lawrence microwave oven that gets things done on both sides, because in Lawrence's martyrology, you know, he's roasted over a grill,
right,
and he tells them,
no way.
Oh, it's when medievalists don't get taken out in public much.
Oh, that is
I'm
so...
sticking to my air fryer.
Oh,
my God.
That is so funny, Leslie. I love that. I did have to look up St. Jane because I thought that she was...
There's a St. Jane, huh?
There's a St. Jane. Yeah. But she was later, and she ended up in a cloister and did good works, but I don't think that she got crushed by a rock or anything. So there goes my hierarchy. Hierarchy.
Yeah, most of the martyrs are early.
I'm a Gregory. There's St. Gregory the Great and a bunch of popes. I'm taken care of.
You got it all covered.
Yeah.
You got it all covered. What are the names of your books, Leslie?
So there is Visions of Sainthood in Medieval Rome. This is a project I did with two good friends. It's a translation and study of a unique Roman woman. She dies in 1280, and she's never canonized. Her family goes to war with the Pope, so it never goes through. But we have these two unfinished lives, one written by her brother and one written by a woman, Sister Stefania, who's maybe her niece. So we've got these really kind of interesting points of view. There's a collection of essays that I did. And then my first book, I'm going to remember exact title, it's Creating Clara of Assisi. And there I'm interested in both the historical woman and then the way later women through the end of the Middle Ages, how they look back at her history and make use of her story. So
that's so interesting. It really is. And it's been just a fascinating time having you here. Thank you so much for joining us. Leslie Knox.
Thank you so much for inviting
me. Great.
Is an associate professor of history at Marquette University. Really appreciate it, Leslie. Thank you. Take care. Stay close. News is coming up next. When we return, we're going to lighten things up and talk golf clothing. You're listening to Matt Nair on Air. This is the Civic Media Radio Network. Good morning and welcome to Matt Nair on Air. Thank you so very much for joining us. Jane Matt Nair, Greg Buck, Sweet Cal B on the board, coming to you from our studio in downtown Waukesha. Wherever you are listening across the state, you can always join the conversation at 855-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842. Leave a comment on the live stream on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter. Just a reminder, if you ever want to get in contact with our show, you can send the email to Jane Says, JaneSays, Jane Says at civicmedia.us. If there's something happening in your community you would like us to cover, something that you think is important to you and your neighbors, you can always let us know. If you have comments and suggestions, Jane Says at civicmedia.us. And a reminder as well to download the Civic Media app, Greg Bach, because coming up in the 1 o'clock hour, Todd Alba will have the next word you need to know in order to enter our Ride Into Spring statewide text-in contest.
I've been wanting to make jokes as like to say, well, the word's definitely not going to be such and such, and say a ridiculous word like, you know, rhododendron or something. But then I'm afraid if I say that, people are like texting rhododendron in because they heard me say it, because that's how much power I have.
Maybe, sure. Okay. It's not.
It's not.
No, it's not. You're going to have to listen at 1 o'clock between 1 and 2 with Todd Alba to find out the word you need to text in so you can be in the running for an overnight stay at the Chula Vista Resort in Wisconsin Dells and one of two grand prizes. So stay tuned for that. Right now, this was in the Journal Sentinel. I saw this yesterday. I have many questions. An upscale lifestyle attire brand is coming to Mayfair Mall later this summer. Travis Matthew is a California-based clothing company offering activewear, casual wear, and golf clothing. They're going to open up a more than 3,600-square-foot store in Mayfair Mall. That's pretty big.
It's not an attire brand, Jane. It's an entire brand.
What is upscale golf clothing? I'm genuinely confused.
Well,
don't you just need a pair of shorts and a shirt with a polo shirt with a collar? Can't you wear a t-shirt? I mean, are you shunned on the golf course if you don't, if you're not wearing a certain kind of belt?
I'm sure that there are golf courses out there that require certain clothing. Those are going to be probably your higher scale.
But that's a country club.
That's a country club. Yeah. I mean, it's all about the look. It's about fitting in. But here's the question I have for all those individuals who play on public courses and feel the need to wear these clothes. Why do you care?
Well, right. If it's a public course, I mean, it's a public course.
Yeah. Why do you need to look like that? Why do you need it? I don't, Travis Matthew, I'm sure there's probably like an $85 shirt that they sell. Why do you need that? And don't tell me wicking technology. Don't tell me it moves better than any other golf shirt I have.
You're not buying it?
No, I'm not buying it, and I'm not buying it.
Travis Matthew, again, a California-based clothing company with upscale activewear, casual wear, and golf clothing, going to be coming to Mayfair Mall. They are planning to open the grand opening in July of this year. So are you a golfer, first of all? What do you wear when you golf? I'm genuinely curious if there is a hierarchy of attire when you're golfing.
There absolutely is. I mean, Travis Matthews exists, then yes.
Calvin?
What is the most expensive thing you've ever bought golf-wise that's gear? Not clubs, balls, shoes. I mean like a shirt, pants, hat. That kind of thing.
Are you a golfer, Kelvin?
Sort of. I played on the high school team, and
you
then
did.
Yeah, and then since then I've decided it costs too much money and it frustrates me too much, so I don't really play that much.
It is expensive. I mean, even public courses,
are
a little pricey.
Yeah. So I figure, why spend $50 to go get mad at myself for 2.5 hours?
It does seem like golf does seem kind of like a lesson in self-flagellation. It's, you know, just beat yourself up about how badly you swung, and it's a good way to ruin a nice walk.
Well, exactly.
I mean, the thing, so for me, like I said to you earlier, my father took me golfing when I was a kid. We'd go to public courses. We wore jeans and t-shirts or whatever. Like we were dressed appropriately, but we were dressed very casual, and it ruffled the feathers of some people out there.
Because
my dad was wearing jeans and a short sleeve polo shirt. He wasn't wearing, it didn't look golf like. It just looked like he was ready to, I don't know, go to the store. Like, but you saw guys in the nice pants. And you want to wear the nice pants?
You want to wear the nice shirt?
Wear all that stuff. That's fine. It ain't going to make your handicap better. It ain't going to make you think that putt on the 17th. But to look at people, especially on a public course, with disdain, like we don't belong.
Would they say things to you?
No, you can just see in the looks or I remember one time we didn't take a cart and someone insinuated that we couldn't afford to get a cart. Like, no, we wanted to walk.
That's just obnoxious.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Golf is one of the most obnoxious sports. And what I love now is they're trying to do this all like we are for everybody. Same with tennis. Tennis, I love tennis. And tennis is like, we're for every person. It's like, you're really for people who can afford to put their children like 3-day-a-week tennis lessons.
Tennis camps.
I mean, and that's the thing too. Golf, as Calvin is saying, it is a frustrating sport because if you want to be even mediocre good, you got to golf all the time and you got to practice all the time. It doesn't just, like, some people are born with a natural talent towards it, but then you have to hone the talent. And that takes a lot of time and money and energy. And if you're a kid, that can drive you to madness because you're usually living out the dreams of your parents.
Did you think you were going to become a pro, Calvin?
Oh, no. I knew I was really bad.
But you were on the team.
Oh, yeah. And I even made varsity a couple times. But
good for you.
Yeah. Like, there was a flight of golfers that were, I would consider, good golfers. And then there was the next step down that's like, they can keep it in place, sort of. And then I was like just below that tier.
I almost think, though, with particularly with golf and maybe just with anything that's athletic, there are some people who are just more inclined to do that and some people who just have natural ability, because golf is so unnatural. The way you hold the club, Robin Williams did a whole very profane spin on it, which is hilarious. If you ever want a good laugh about golf, go to YouTube and look up Robin Williams and golf.
Yeah.
But it's just an awkward, I just find the whole thing awkward.
I mean, it's fun when you go with friends and you're having a good time. No one takes it seriously. You do best ball. You just try
best ball. I like,
try to get it through as you know, I don't want to be in a foursome and be on the course for 9 hours. Like, that's not fun to me, but I will definitely get in a cart and drive around for a couple hours with friends and just be dumb and not worry about writing anything down. That's, to me, the fun of it. We got a text from the 414 listening on WMDX, says, fake it until you make it, and nice golf clothes definitely help with that. I golf, and you want to look the part even on public courses. This is Carrie from Tosa.
Okay.
And then, Robert says, don't take your insecurities out on someone else. You don't know what they're thinking. Please don't pretend it. I don't know what that means, but when people are rude to me, I kind of know what they're thinking.
Well, Robert says, why do you care what they choose to wear? Whatever they wear should make them happy, whether it's expensive or not. Absolutely. I don't like the idea of people being shamed at a public course because someone else has a fancier shirt on.
Or feeling the pressure to wear it because it's like, I got to buy this. I don't know. Yeah, you know what? We're whining right now, and that's fine. We do it every once in a while. It's cool. And someone sent the thing saying, a recent study found that the average golfer walks about 900 miles a year. Another study found golfers drink on average 22 gallons of alcohol a year, which means on average a golfer gets about 41 miles to the gallon. Kind of makes you proud. I'm almost like a hybrid.
That's Tom from New Berlin said that, and that's hilarious.
Yeah. I mean, golf is a totally elitist sport, but also it can be, if you're in the right mind, the best time ever.
Well, I'm thinking now the three of us and we need to grab somebody else. We'll get a foursome and we'll go out someday this summer to a public course.
Todd Alba.
And do Brian. And do best ball.
Yeah. Fancy Brian.
We need to have a whole civic media golf outing and have a competition between shows.
Ooh.
What are you doing, Calvin? Oh, my gosh.
No, I made it not fun by making it a competition.
Right, exactly. You're sucking all the joy out of it.
No, it'll be like a fun scramble. Exactly. Fundraiser, maybe.
Yeah, we could sell our Bibles, too. The Civic Media Bible. Only $49.99.
Exactly.
I saw a wonderful video of a guy hit the ball and just do poorly, and he was getting really, really angry, and his buddy goes, left hand anger, and he takes his less dominant hand and tries to throw the club and just throws it like a baby, so he takes his anger out. I would do that too, because that's golf, volleyball, bowling. Those are three sports that when I engage in, I become a different human.
Really?
I become very competitive. I get angry very fast. Because I don't know why those three sports, I don't care. Like, I love baseball. I'll never play it. I won't be good. I won't play football. I won't play basketball. And if I did, I'd be like, whatever. But for some reason, golf, volleyball, and bowling turns me into a nightmare.
I've heard that happens to a lot of people on the golf course.
Yeah.
Which, again, makes it sound like so much fun.
Well, if you're sitting back on the cart drinking, it's like Greg's going to try to throw a ball into the highway again.
Let's not lose our tempers so much when we're supposed to be out there enjoying ourselves.
Yes, right? Indeed.
It's supposed to be a hobby.
Oh, yep. WMDX listener on the 414. I think this might still be Carrie. Yep, Carrie from Tosa. Make it a fundraiser and invite the audience. I'm in.
Well, start working.
Calvin,
you're
in charge of that. Calvin, let us know how that goes.
Yeah, Calvin's going to lead this off now, and we'll get back to you.
Yeah.
Let you know how that's going. All right. This, again, Travis Matthews coming to Mayfair soon if you're looking for fancy schmancy golf wear.
Do you realize that in our complaining about this, we just gave them like 15 minutes of advertising?
We'll never mention it again.
Who? Travis who?
Coming up, our civic media meteorologist, Brittany Merlot, is going to join us for a little weather and wine on a Wednesday.
Are we going to talk about bacon a little bit, too?
We are going to talk about bacon. Speaking of giving out free advertisements, Greg Bach.
And still getting nothing in return.
They're making changes at Culver's.
Yep.
Coming up on Monday, April 1st, not an April Fool's Day prank. Culver's is unveiling a new smoky thick-cut bacon, and they will offer bacon free on any sandwich on the day of its arrival.
We had a discussion about this. About Calvin, you said you like crispy bacon. Jane, you said you like crispy
bacon.
Very,
very thin crispy bacon.
Very thin crispy bacon. Okay.
Yep.
Now, I know this is where you're out of the picture on this one, because, and this is a direct quote from the article in the Post Crescent, the new bacon is cooked using a proprietary method on the grill that leaves it chewy on the inside and crispy edges. That's kind of my bacon jam.
Is it?
If I'm going to eat bacon, which I don't do often, I like some chewy with some crispy. I don't want to bite into it and just have bacon bits.
Oh, see, and that's what I love.
You and my mother-in-law.
That's perfect bacon, baby.
Now that I know this is in relation to Culver's, I am kind of upset.
Why? Like,
Culver's Bacon Deluxe was perfect the way it is. Why would they change something?
It was perfect. What are you doing?
Man. It's your first old man opinion, Calvin. look at him. You're truly a grump now. Back when I was a kid, the bacon was fine, and then they went and changed it in 24, and I never went back there again.
You know what, too, Calvin? The secret to getting really, really good crispy bacon is you bake it.
I have heard that.
You bake it, you put it on, you set the oven, you preheat the oven for 400, and then you put the bacon in on a sheet.
Yeah.
And it will, within 15 minutes, you will have the perfect.
You want people to wait 15 minutes for their bacon?
Extra crunchy bacon. It's fantastic.
My mother-in-law will just make bacon and have it like sitting on the counter and pick it up throughout the day. I love that. Like, it's amazing.
It is one of those things that. Yeah. It's probably not good for us, but ooh,
it's
so good.
Carcinogen, so right. No, it's not.
When we return, Brittany Merlot will be here for Weather and Wine. Stay with us. You're listening to Matt Nair on Air, coming to you on the Civic Media Radio Network.
Later on the golf course, after drinking tea, it started raining golf balls. She protected me, her name was Pat. And we sat under a tree.
Thank you so much for joining us. Welcome to Matt Nair on Air. Jane Matt Nair, Greg Bach, Sweet Gal B on the board, coming to you from our studio in downtown Waukesha. You can always join us too. Call or text at 855-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842, or leave a comment on the live stream if you're watching on Facebook, YouTube, and what used to be Twitter. She joins us just about every Wednesday at this time. We've had to do a little rescheduling here and there, but Brittany Merlot, our Civic Media meteorologist, joining us for what we call a little weather and wine. How you doing, Brittany?
I'm fantastic. How are you guys?
We're good.
Peachy.
We're just peachy. What are we looking at for the weather?
We're just going straight into the weather, aren't we?
We'll get to bacon in a minute.
Okay, so obviously it's cold out there. Those winds are still whipping. Wind chills are ranging anywhere from about the single digits to the low 20s.
Woof.
So our average, right, what it really feels like out there, our average is about 15 degrees statewide. Yay!
That is so crazy. Yesterday, granted, it was rainy and gray, but it was still almost 50 degrees. And then to drop so precipitously overnight, so are we going to be warming up as we head into Easter weekend? Because I'm sure people had hiding eggs and things like that outside planned.
Absolutely. So good news is we are going to warm things up for the weekend, but there is a shot of a little bit of precipitation that wants to move in, mainly on Saturday. And it looks like the heaviest hit could be about a half an inch or so down in towards Milwaukee, Kenosha area. But
are we talking rain or snow?
Rain. Rain. Yes, exactly. And if you are north of Highway 29, though, you could see a shot of snow on Saturday.
Well,
Not much, though.
And they just got, the Eau Claire area just got 10 inches of snow, right?
Yes, Eau Claire, all the way to Wausau. We were buried in snow and it all rapidly melted. And then we got 2 inches of rain on top of that.
Wow.
So our rivers are rising. And in fact, a lot of rivers here are about 6 feet higher than they were before this event happened.
Did you walk around your house just stirring cocoa, looking out saying, I told you so?
You know what I did? I went to a closed sledding tubing hill and I trekked all the way up there by foot. It's usually got the, you know, the lifts that take you up there. Yep. I sledded like a little kid and I haven't done that in a couple years.
Did you really? How fun.
And it was raining. This was when it was raining still.
Yeah.
And it was slushy underneath the snow and I got stopped a few times and rolled, but you know what? It was worth it. And the precipitation, we needed it.
Yes.
72% of the state, right? In a drought. And now the new drought monitor should come out tomorrow and hopefully a lot better.
Oh, that would be good because I know that we've already had something like 50 wildfires, which is, that's unprecedented. Yeah. We certainly have never had that many this early in the year. So
I agree.
I was going to say that the before the snow, you were correct, as I think I told you earlier in the week, when I woke up the morning of the snowstorm last Friday, there was a little bit on the lawn, mostly raining. And by the Sunday, all snow that had fallen down in Kenosha was gone. But the lawn was greener and it was just nicer, which means I have to mow now.
Yeah, that's around the corner. And the mosquitoes. Ooh.
All right.
Sorry. Everybody wants spring and the warmth. Like, let the mosquitoes come with it.
There's always a catch. There's always a catch somewhere. All right, let's move on to bacon. We were doing a little bacon roundtable because Culver's is going to be changing the type of bacon that they use starting on Monday. They will go to a new smoky, thick-cut bacon as opposed to the thinner-cut bacon they have right now. Calvin and I are on one side. We like it paper thin, so when you bite into it, it just turns into bacon bits. And Greg is on the chewier bacon side.
Don't say it like that. No, objection. That's leading the witness. You can't talk like that. Look, I'll eat the bacon that you like. It's fine. It's just that I choose to have crispy on the outside with a little bit of chewy in the middle. And according to the proprietary cooking knowledge of Culver's, that's what they'll be offering.
Where do you come down on the big bacon debate, Brittany Merlot?
Crispy. Thin and crispy. Cool. Always.
See, here's the thing, Brittany. Something you need to know about Greg Bach. When I hear people's opinions that don't jive with mine, I'm fine with it. Whereas Jane's got to present it in a way that makes me feel like I'm an idiot. Like, he likes it. No, Jane, I'm understanding and tolerant. These are a bunch of bacon prejudiced people right here. I'm surrounded by them. Calvin, cut their mics.
I will take any kind of bacon, though, over no bacon.
How's okay. That? All right.
I would agree with that. But Calvin's upset because he said they're ruining your perfect sandwich.
Yeah. I actually agree with Greg to an extent for, like, just eating bacon, like, for breakfast or, like, a snack or, like, on a BLT. But as far as the Culver's bacon burger, I don't understand why they're changing it.
Now, yes. See, that's where I'll agree. If it's too chewy on the burger, then you're pulling it apart. But also, can we all get together? And a BLT is the most waste of time. It's just it's a salad on bread.
I agree. I had turkey, so then it's not really a
BLT.
There it
is.
Yep.
Okay, here's another war. Now it's going to be BLT wars. Because
bacon, lettuce, and tomato. Wow. Oh, cool. I'll see you in 20 minutes when you're hungry again.
No. That Rochester Deli right down from here has the best BLT you will ever have in your life.
Jane, those words mean nothing to me. The best BLT, that's like the best kick in the shins.
All right. How about a bacon-wrapped avocado slice? Have you guys ever had that?
That sounds good.
Mix a little health with none. Perfect.
Doctor, I'm eating more avocados. That's wonderful. It's wrapped in bacon. Oh, man.
And deep fried, but it's fabulous.
Your gout's still bad.
Brittany Merlot is our meteorologist with Civic Media. She joins us every Wednesday at this time for weather and wine. Thank you so much, Brittany. Have a wonderful Easter, and we will see you next week.
See ya. Yes, you too. Thank you.
Stay close. We have news coming up next, followed by the one and only Todd Father, the Todd Alba Program. from noon to 2 p.m. Todd will have the next word you want to text in via the Civic Media app for our text to win right into spring statewide contest. Be listening between 1 and 2 for that. Thank you so much, Greg and Calvin. Without you guys, nothing works. And thank you, everyone, for calling and for listening and for texting. It means everything. I hope you find some joy today and you have the chance to share it. Stay here. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.